The following is a class on the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Chapter number 6, text number 27. Given by His Grace, Sriman Sankarshanda Sathikari. Recorded on May 25th, 2011, in London, United Kingdom.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Prashanta Manasam Hi Enam Yoginam Sukam Utamam Upaiti Shantarajasam Brahmabhutam Akalmasham Prashanta Manasam Hienam Yoginam Sukamuttamam Upaiti Shanta Rajasam Brahmabhutam Akalmasham Prashanta Manasam Hienam Yoginam Sukamuttamam Upaiti Shanta Rajasam Brahmabhutam Akalmasham. Prashanta, peaceful, fixed on the lotus feet of Krishna. Manasam, whose mind? He, certainly. Enam, this. Yoginam, yogi. Sukham, happiness. Uttamam, the highest. Upaiti, attains. Shantarajasam, his passion pacified. Brahmabhutam, liberation by identification with the Absolute. Akalmasham, freed from all past sinful reactions. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The yogi, whose mind is fixed on me, verily attains the highest perfection of transcendental happiness. He is beyond the mode of passion. He realizes his qualitative identity with the Supreme, and thus he is freed from all reactions to past deeds. Purport. Brahmabhuta is the state of being free from material contamination and situated in the transcendental service of the Lord. Mag Bhaktim Labhate Param, Bhagavad Gita 18:54. One cannot remain in the quality of Brahman, the Absolute, unless one's mind is fixed on the lotus feet of the Lord. Savai Mana Krishna Padaravindayo. To be always engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, or to remain in Krishna consciousness, is to be factually liberated from the mode of passion and all material contamination. Vandeha Sri Guru Sri Jata Vada Kamala Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupa
Sangra jata Sahagana Raghunathan vitam tam sajiva sadaitam zavadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha.
So tonight we're studying about the yogi. Not just any yogi, but the topmost yogi. What does yogi mean? Well, what does yoga mean? Yoga has appeared in English, according to the etymologists. It has appeared in English as the word yoke. So, what does the yoke do? It links the ox with the plow. So, yoga, or yoke, means link. So, the yogi means one who is yoked or linked with the Supreme. So, what is the benefit of being a yogi? Being linked with the Supreme, what is that benefit? That is described here by Krishna. He verily attains, verily means truthfully or factually, he verily attains the highest perfection of transcendental happiness. Well, there are so many people in this world seeking so many types of perfection. Some want to become rich, some want to become famous, some want to become powerful, some want to become beautiful. Some want to be recognized as great humanitarianists or great renunciates. And there are so many types of perfections which are sought by the people of this world. But here, the Supreme Person, Krishna, is describing what is the highest perfection. And that highest perfection is described here as transcendental happiness. What is the meaning of transcendental happiness? I mean, you can go out on Oxford Street and you see so many people smiling and laughing, apparently very happy, you see. So what is the difference between Oxford Street happiness and transcendental happiness? Oxford Street happiness is depending on what's going on around you at the moment. If you have a pretty girl with you or it's a nice spring afternoon, you know, you have money and you have credit on your charge card, etc., then you can be happy, you see. That's not transcendental happiness. That is happiness which is dependent on material circumstances. That happiness is flickering. In Sanskrit, it's called chanchala. You understand? Sometimes it's here, sometimes it's not here. You see? I'm really happy. I got a beautiful girlfriend, but tomorrow she left and went with somebody else. Oh, you see? Where did my happiness go? You see? But transcendental happiness does not depend on any material situation. Absolutely does not depend on any material situation. You can be young, you can be old, you can be healthy, you can be sick, you can be famous, you can be unknown, you can be hated, you can be loved, you can be strong, you can be weak. You can name any and all varieties of situations that one can find oneself in this material existence, even all the way to becoming Brahma, the chief demigod of the entire material universe that we live in. You see? But this is a happiness which has nothing to do with any particular situation. It's just this linking or being connected or being synchronized or harmonized perfectly with the supreme source of all existence. That's all you need. Don't need any props. That's all you need. You just need Krishna consciousness. Someone may say, oh, come on, this is pie in the sky. You're feeding me some of this Hare Krishna baloney. Come on, knock it off. Get real with me, you see. But no, this is a scientific thing, and we can show you how it's true. You see? Here in Britain, you have your Dr. Hawking. Dr. Hawking says the universe comes out of absolutely nothing, and they celebrate him as the greatest brain in the world, Dr. Hawking. You see? But I ask you, where is the scientific experiment? Show me, Dr. Hawking, your experiment where you took nothing and you got something. Show me in your laboratory where you've done that, where you've taken nothing and you've gotten something out of it. You see? This is mere hypothesis. There is no facts to back it up. Anybody can hypothesize anything. I can say the absolute truth is a giraffe. This is the new absolute truth. It's called giraffe consciousness. We're going to form a society, the International Society for Giraffe Consciousness. And you all have to develop long necks now to be a member of the society. You see, we'll put special braces on you to make your necks longer. And you can become a member of the International Society for Giraffe Consciousness. See, anybody can say anything, you see. But where is the scientific proof? Where is your evidence? You claim to be a scientist, sir. Where is your scientific evidence of something in the laboratory, in the test tube, anywhere where you want to do your experiment, where you can take nothing and get something, you see? There's no example. Everything comes from something, which came from something, which came from something, 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 back, until you finally come to a something which didn't come from something, and that is the original substance, the primordial substance. That is the origin, that is the source of existence. So then, what is the nature of that source? From that source, so many persons have come out. I'm a person, you're a person. So what is the nature? That it's like a gold mine has to have gold to produce gold. To get gold out of a gold mine, there must be gold in the gold mine. So to get persons out of the existential mine, that existential mind must possess personality. Therefore, saying it is okay in one sense, but it's not really the most accurate way of describing it. That original source is person, you see. So the yogi is that person who is reestablished. And why do I say reestablished? Because originally the living entity in his pure, pristine consciousness has a loving relationship with that Supreme Person. Every single living entity in his original pristine state of consciousness, unadulterated pure consciousness, has a loving relationship with that Supreme Person. It's like when the rain falls from the sky as Prabhupada explains, it is pure distilled water, but when it contacts the earth, it becomes muddy water. So, in our original pure, pristine state of consciousness, before we fell into contact with the material modes of passion, goodness, and ignorance, we had a pure state of consciousness. That pure state of consciousness means a loving relationship with that Supreme Person. Now, who that Supreme Person is, that has been analyzed by great scientists, by the greatest scientists, who had the most powerful scientific instrument which has ever been discovered. Do you know what that instrument is? Consciousness. Pure consciousness. So that, by scientific analysis, by scientific investigation, the greatest scientists who use the instrument known as consciousness have all agreed that Supreme Person is Krishna. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita by Arjuna. Ahus ahustang rishaya sarve dirvarsha nadalastata asito devila vyasa svayam chaiva bhavishime. All the great personalities, Devarshi Narada, Vyasadev, Asita, Devila Vyasa, they have all confirmed this truth about you that you're speaking to me today, Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita. They've all confirmed it's true. And it's amazing. I've heard all, they've all confirmed it, and now you yourself are saying the same thing that they've been saying about you. You're saying it about yourself. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, text number 13. So, that Supreme Person is the source of all existence. He is Krishna. Of course, it's not his only name. I mean, you can call him Allah, Jehovah, Govinda, Shamasundra. He has millions of names. I mean, my father had many different names. My mother called him one thing, his old college buddies called him something else, his parents called him something else. You see, he had so many different names. My father had so many different names. He's an ordinary man of this world. He had at least three or four different names. So if an ordinary man of this world can have three or four different names, what about the Supreme Person as the source of all existence? Well, how many names could he have? Maybe five or six? No, millions of names. Unlimited millions of names. You see. So that Supreme Person with unlimited millions of names, well, then why say Krishna? Well, why not? If all the names are bona fide, why we can't call him by one of them? If I say, but you have 10,000 names, so I can't address you by any name, is that really good philosophy? I can't call you any name because you have 10,000 names. Is that really good philosophy?
I like Krishna.
Huh? It's not good philosophy. Do you have 10,000 names, so I can't use any of them? No. If you have 10,000 names, I can choose one name, you see. So why the name Krishna? The name Krishna is used because Krishna is a name which means the all-attractive one. Each and every single name of God is one of his attractive features, just like a multifaceted diamond. So, the best name of God is that name which includes all the other names. When you say Krishna, you're already chanting every other name of God automatically within it. So, if chanting the name of God is potent and powerful, and it is according to the revealed scriptures, then to chant the name Krishna is the most powerful, most potent, because that name includes within it those two vibrations, those two syllables, Krishna, include every other name of God, and all the millions and billions of names for that Supreme Person are all contained within these two syllables, Krishna. Compact within these two syllables are every one of the millions and billions of names for the Supreme Source of all existence. So therefore, Jai Shri Shri Bhadra Bhadalana Nishvara Jai Jagamah Baladev Subhadra. So this name is very powerful, it's very potent, Krishna. So the yogi means he has re-established. Why do I say re-established? Because originally, as I mentioned earlier, originally the living entity being part and parcel of that Supreme, being an emanation of that Supreme Person, he has a loving relationship. It is called qualitative oneness. By that loving relationship, one is qualitatively one. He's totally enwrapped in a loving relationship with the Supreme Source of all existence, Krishna. So the same qualities that are seen in the Supreme are mirrored in him. Supreme is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss, and the individual living entity is also eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. But because the Supreme possesses unlimited independence, that quality of independence is also mirrored in the living entity, the part and parcel living entity. And if he misuses that independence by trying to imitate the Supreme, that why should I accept somebody else as the center of existence, the origin of everything? I think I'd like to be the center of existence. So the Supreme Person says, all right, if you want to try that out, go ahead. My dear son, if you want to try that, being in my position, I'm not going to tell you no. You go ahead and try it, and when you realize what a foolish mistake it was, then you can come back and be my eternal servant once again. So this material well is a special place for all those persons who want to try to imitate the Supreme by being the Supreme themselves. You ever wonder why people were so cocky? You ever wonder why are they so cocky? You know, everybody's so cocky. This is a place for the cockies. This is cocky loka, you see. This is everybody's cocky here. That's why they're born here, you see. Everybody's cocky here, puffed up, you see. So, you can try to be happy by being cocky, but it really doesn't work because no matter how cocky you are, you're going to be subdued by birth, death, old age, and disease. You'll be forced to experience these miserable conditions. Like it or not, you're going to be forced to experience them. Therefore, the intelligent person realizes there's something wrong here. There's something unnatural about this atmosphere. Because within my heart, I want unlimited happiness at every minute. I want pure peace, pure love, pure happiness, pure knowledge, pure understanding. I want these things. I hanker for them, but yet somehow I don't get them here. There's something wrong about this situation I'm in right now, you see. When a person, this is very rare. Most people think, yeah, just give me some money. They just think, I just got to get enough money, I'll be happy. But some people who are philosophically inclined, they realize, wait a minute. Somebody getting ahead materially, what's the use? When I was a kid in college, I remember. I was thinking, what's the use of all these things? Study hard, you get good grades, you get a good degree, you get a good job, you get a good wife, you get a good house, you get some good kids, you get a good car, you get a good coffin. You see? What's the point of the whole thing? Life could not simply be that only. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. God couldn't be so cruel that this would be all there was. It just didn't make sense to me. So I started looking. I was taking all these courses on Western culture. There was nothing in Western culture. They didn't even tell us there was such a thing as Easterns. Eastern culture was like something out there in the wilderness, you know, the outback. As they have in Australia, you know. It's just like the Wild West or the Wild East, something out there beyond civilization. You know, it all began and our study of Western culture was, it all began in Baghdad, the Tigris and the Euphrates. That was the cradle of civilization. Iraq was the cradle of our wonderful civilization. Can you imagine Iraq being the cradle of our civilization? No wonder it's such a crazy civilization. So we studied all the great thinkers all the way from the Greeks. Of course, Prabhupada confirmed Socrates had very good knowledge. He taught Brahman realization, actually, on a certain level. They said he was actually challenging. He wanted to show that people didn't really know anything. He wanted to expose the ignorance and the hypocrisy in the Athenian culture, the Greek culture. And he was constantly defeating everyone philosophically, proving that they didn't really know what they were talking about, showing they were fools. He showed everybody through philosophical debate that they were fools. And this was more than the authorities could handle. This is too much, you know. Socrates is showing they were a bunch of fools. So they said, okay, that's it. You have to die. And here's some poison, hemlock. You must drink this hemlock poison now. But they had some respect for him as a great sage. And they said, well, but first tell us, how would you like to be buried? That was his response. You have to catch me first. He knew he was not his buddy, you see. He had very good philosophical knowledge, just Socrates, you see. But then his disciple Plato, he very nicely presented his Gurmash, Socrates' teachings. But then the disciple of Plato, Aristotle, he went into what we now call empiricism. Before that time, there was an idea of a parampara, a tradition of knowledge being passed down from the previous learned sages, you see. But with Aristotle, it was a break from that idea. Now it's all going to be based on empirical, what we can see, you see, empirical knowledge. So Aristotle's the father of modern-day empiricism, giving up the idea of deductive knowledge from previous authorities and basing it on inductive knowledge, whatever you can induce from your senses, you see. We have Aristotle to thank for them. Aris Bogle is the one who brought in this empiricism. So, studying such thinkers, Marcus Aurelius told us, well, you just got to tough it out, you know, just got to be, all the suffering, we just got to be tough, and that's the way to deal with it, just tough your way through it, you know. And that was his solution for the sufferings of material existence, just got to be tough. But who wants to die being tough? I mean, what do you actually achieve by being, you know, hey, okay, death, you rascal. Try to be tough, but still death will take you. What is the advantage of Marcus Aurelius's philosophy of being tough with the miseries? You still have to subdue to them. You don't conquer them. You can speak roughly with your conqueror, but you're conquered. You see? You may act very tough with your conqueror, but he'll put your handcuffs on your hands and put them behind your back and put you in the cell. What is the good of being tough with your conqueror? You see? So we studied all these philosophers up to the medieval Kant, and we went through Hegel and Heidegger and came all the way to the modern-day existentialists, and just like this Camus, you see. He said life has no meaning, and he proved they really believed it. He drove his car off a cliff, committed suicide, you see. It's a chain smoker also. So what is the value of these philosophers, you see? What can they teach you how to be happy? You see? So in spite of all of this, all being exposed in our college there, to all these great thinkers, and nothing answered the questions. How can I be happy? Who am I? What is the purpose of my existence? You see, no one had any idea. But finally, I was fortunate, after years of intense search and intense anguish of separation from that pristine state of enlightened consciousness, I was blessed by the association of Srila Prabhupada and his disciples, who actually helped me to understand who I really am, that I'm not this body, I'm an eternal spiritual being, quality one with God, and qualitatively one with God, and how to actually become reestablished in that consciousness in all times, all places and circumstances. It's not that you have to live in the ashram even. In India, you can be a working man, you can be a rock star, you can be like George Harrison, you can be in any occupation, any situation, and practice this science of Bhagavad that's explained very carefully and clearly in the Bhagavad Gita, and make your life perfect. You can become a yogi, a bhakti yogi, that's the highest yoga. And it's further described here. He's beyond the mode of passion. I really like the way this is the in the word for word. Shantarajasam. His passion pacified. And that's a very interesting concept. The translation says beyond the mode of passion. The Sanskrit word for word is literally saying Shantarajasam. It's always good to look at the word for word and the translation because you can get different shades of meaning and see different angles. So having passion pacified and being beyond the mode of passion are actually the two ways of saying the same thing. It's a very interesting concept. Passion pacified. Shanta means pacified. Rajasam is passion. You see, passion pacified. In other words, it's not that your passion is frustrated. I have this passionate tendency and it's I just have to ignore it and I'm frustrated. No, it's actually pacified. The rajasic nature, the tendency to do, to act, you see. Now some transcendentalists, they say, well, you just have to stop acting and just go to the Himalayas, get a cave and just sit there. And chant some om, do some pranayama and that's it for the rest of your life, you see. The difficulty with that, it doesn't really pacify your passion. You're trying to ignore your passion, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You can't ignore your passion. You have to engage your passion in such a way that it becomes pacified. And that is done by the bhakti yogi. You see, therefore he is called the highest yogi. This is confirmed in text 47 of this same chapter. Of all the yogis, this type of yogi, the one who connects himself with Krishna through love and devotion, this yogi namapi sarve sham man gatena taratmana, this yogi is the highest of all yogis. His tendency to act is fully pacified because he's very active. Just like now here I am, I'm on an around-the-world lecture tour. Very active, flying here, flying there, going to this country, that country. Very, very active, you see. Well, I tell my wife here, Vishnupriya Devi Dasi, you see. We're traveling all over the world. It's not that we're just sitting in some place, Om Shanti. No. We're very actively, you know, packing our bags, getting to the airport, checking in, you know, checking in, the whole thing. Very, very active. But this activity is not being done for sense enjoyment. This is being done for the satisfaction of the Lord. Our spiritual master has ordered us, you see, that we must spread this knowledge to every country all over the world. So we're trying to serve our spiritual master's order, you see. And this is transcendental passion. The shandarajasam, you see. The passion becomes completely pacified when you use it in Krishna's service. So whatever tendency you have to act, if you're a writer, write for Krishna. If you're a singer, sing for Krishna. If you're a dancer, dance for Krishna. If you're a cook, cook for Krishna. If you're a manager, manage for Krishna. If you're a businessman, make millions and billions of dollars for Krishna. And see, whatever tendency you have for acting, you don't have to say, oh, I have to turn it off. No, engage that active tendency in Krishna's service, you see. And then you become so pacified you couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe there was such a peaceful state of mind that could ever exist. You see, I never could believe it, you see. You actually enter into a state which is so full of joy, so full of peace, where that you just have this feeling of love overflowing your heart, where you just feel like love giving love to every single living entity you see wherever you go all over the world, you see, because you see these are all Krishna's children. They've forgotten him. I have to reconnect them with Krishna. This is the highest love. So it's a very exciting life. One of my students in Austin, we're just getting ready to leave my ashram there in Austin, giving me a head out on an around the world tour. He said, "Well, are you excited?" I said, "I'm excited being here also. I'm always excited. Not that I have to travel to get excited. I'm excited just being here at our home base in Austin." See, Krishna consciousness means excitement at every minute. Because you don't need it. Just remember Krishna, that's the ultimate excitement. Wow, Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. That's all you need. All you have to do is remember Krishna. And you can experience the ultimate excitement. More excitement than winning $1 million in the lottery. More exciting than just remembering Krishna is the ultimate excitement. More exciting than being elected the prime minister. You know, any kind of thing you can get in the material world. You know, having a platinum album, you know, for your latest songs you wrote, the platinum album, you selling more than the Beatles did or something. You know, you don't need anything. All you need is remembering Krishna. That is the ultimate excitement. So, this process that we are teaching, it is coming from Prabhupada. I'm just the messenger. I'm just a little tiny messenger of Srila Prabhupada. That's it. I'm bringing to you, from my 40 years of strictly following his teachings without any deviation, 24 hours a day, I'm simply bringing you what I've realized with 40 years of strictly following Srila Prabhupada. Sharing with you what I've realized and hopefully it inspired you to go deeper and deeper and deeper into this nectarian ocean of Krishna Bhakti, Krishna consciousness, and taste the sweetest, most sublime juice you could ever drink in all in millions and billions of lifetimes. So we got about 10 minutes left. Are there any questions?
Thanks for the class. Very inspiring. But when we're in the mode of goodness, by practicing Krishna consciousness, we first come into this mode of goodness feeling quite happy and satisfied. But we need to move into this transcendental. How can we know when we are not just
transitioning from goodness to pure goodness? The mode of goodness we likely recognize. I'm a great humanitarian. Just like I went to my ear doctor the other day, and he had just come back from Bangladesh, where he was. He had gone to do some charity work, but he printed out a copy of the whole article and handed it to me to read on the airplane. Coming back, he wanted me to see what a great humanitarian he was. You see, when you want to be recognized for your great activities, you see. And people are acting in the mode of goodness, but they want to make sure that they're noticed for it, you see. I want to be recognized as a great humanitarian. But one who is beyond the mode, but the one of the qualities of the Vaishnava is Prabhupada is silent, you see. Silent worker, he doesn't require any recognition even for his service. He doesn't need to be seen. "Oh, Prabhu, you're such a wonderful devotee." He doesn't need them. Doesn't require to be propped up by anything. The service itself is completely all he needs. That's pure goodness. You see, it's the service itself. Completely satisfied. That's one way of distinguishing if you're getting beyond the modes. Even if the whole world hates you for what you're doing, it doesn't matter. Praise and scorn are completely the same thing for a person who's transcendentally situated. He's satisfied simply to serve Krishna with no thought of return. Not even subtle return. He doesn't even have to go back to Godhead. Well, Krishna, I'm going to serve you, but you know, you got to take me back to Godhead. No. Person who's transcendentally situated, he doesn't think, oh, he thinks, that doesn't matter to me. I can stay in this material world and serve for millions and billions of lifetimes. It doesn't matter. I just want to serve Krishna. I don't need to go back to Godhead. I don't need that as an impetus. I don't need any reward, even going back to Godhead. Lord Chaitanya confirmed this point. Nadanam nadanam dasundarim kavitam vajagadisha kamaye mama janmani janmanishvare bhavatat bhakti rahaita kitve. I have no desire for wealth, women or followers. I don't even need to get liberation from the cycle of birth and death. You see, that's pure bhakti. Completely free of needing anything from Krishna. The only thing I want is more opportunities for service. Give me more service. That's pure bhakti. If there's any conditions, even nice conditions, you see, then you're not in pure bhakti. Yeah. Does that help? All right. Any other questions? Yes?
What makes bhakti yoga the highest yoga?
What makes bhakti yoga the highest yoga? Krishna describes it as such, but why does Krishna say that? Of course, Krishna is accepted by all the great sages as the supreme authority, and he authoritatively states the highest yoga, but at the same time, we want to know why Krishna says that, so our intelligence is satisfied. There are the Hatha yogis who are doing the mystic cities, the deep breathing, who are going for the mystic cities. They are doing they're following the do's, the do nots, the pranayama, the deep breathing, the asanas. For what purpose? They want to get mystic powers. So even they're doing great penances and austerities to transcend their bodily identification, they still have something they want in return. They want mystic powers, you see. That's called, and there's also the Jnana Yogis. The Jnana Yogis, they are also doing great penances and austerities to realize they're not the body, but they want to become one non-different from the Supreme. They want to become the Supreme themselves. So they have something they want out of God for themselves. So the Jnana Yogis, they want to become God. The mystic yogis, they call Hatha or Ashtanga yogis, they want mystic powers. But the reason the bhakti yogi is the highest, he doesn't ask anything in return. His mood is pure giving without anything in return. It's like Christ says, it's better to give than to receive. You see? So they are in the mood purely of giving, not even a slight tinge of a desire to take something. Pure giving, that's why they're considered the highest. They're the pure givers, without any tinge of want something in return. Any other question? Yeah.
If you can help me understand the origin of the demon, I mean, because you say that every person, you know, look back. It comes from the person, the supreme person. I mean, everything is emanated from Krishna.
Yes.
So this demon, are they got soul? They belong to the is part and parcel of Krishna, like every
soul is part and parcel of Krishna. So what's the question?
His question is that the demon is also the part and parcel.
Yeah, actually, no. In the highest sense, no one is demon. And in their pure, in their original state, there's no such thing as a demon. A demon means one who gives up that original consciousness. In the original state, everyone's a devotee. Prabhupada actually said, every living entity is nityasiddha. He's an eternally liberated soul, nityasiddha. But he gives up that position trying to imitate the Supreme. So then he is called demon. Just like the natural condition for the body is to be healthy. Sickness is an unnatural state. So demon simply means sick consciousness. That's him. And when he becomes healed, he gets over the sickness, he becomes devotee comes back to his original position of devotee. It's like water. What's its original, what's its natural state? Liquid. You can artificially freeze it and make ice. But when it comes back to its natural state, it is water. So, in the frozen state, we are demon. In the natural state, we are water. Devotee.
So it's an artifact state of the natural being.
Artificial state of a natural being.
Demon is artificial state. If someone is a demon, he's not being his natural self, he's being an artificial self.
The ice is water in one artificial state.
Yeah, ice is...
So if the demon, they are soul but sick, and they become demon because they are not in natural state, they become sick in an artificial state.
Artificial state, they're not loving, instead of trying to love God, they're trying to just love themselves only, you see.
No, I seek this because I can discover my origin, where I come from.
Well, see, it's kind of like the hand and the stomach. Krishna is like the stomach and we're like the hand. Now, if the hand tries to enjoy the food separately, you know, take the rice and squeeze it in the fingers, you know, how much nutrition will the hand get out of that rice? Nothing. But when the hand feeds the rice to the belly, then it goes through the bloodstream, the hand gets its nourishment. So the hand that tries to enjoy separately, that's called demon. And the hand that feeds the belly, that's called devotee. So to not serve God, that's foolishness. All you're doing is cutting off your own supply line. All you're doing is cutting off your own energy. Well, our time is up. I thank you all very much for coming. And if anybody would like to speak with me, I can meet with you outside in the hall after the club. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai.